another exciting episode of the That's So Cincinnati podcast. I'm Burl Love, editor of the Cincinnati Enquirer, and with me today as our co-host is none other than the James Beard Award-winning food writer, Mr. Keith Pandolfi.
Boy, you didn't have to say the James Beard Award thing, but I appreciate
it. Oh, yes, I did. You were expecting it.
I was not.
And, our food writer extraordinaire, he is our co-host today because our special guest is James Beard nominee, Mike Stankovich.
Mm-hmm. A finalist, not just a semifinalist, but a finalist. And the winners will be announced June 6th. I think it's June 6th, but...
I think you're right.
In Chicago at the Lyric Theater. So,
yes. All right. Well, tell us a little bit about Mike for our listeners who might not know.
Mike is a great guy. I met him before I moved back to Cincinnati when I went into his bar Longfellow in Over the Rhine. If you haven't been, you should go. Just one of the nicest guys in the world. Hires everybody that works for him is wonderful. What I liked about Longfellow when it opened up, it was the most neighborhoody bar in Over the Rhine. Like, it really felt like it was own little community when you walked inside of it. He also owns Mid City over on Court Street, a great restaurant, more food focused than cocktail focused, but still a great place. And yeah, former rock star. He was in the hardcore band Striking Distance.
Striking Distance.
In Washington, D.C., if you're a hardcore fan, you may have heard of that.
Which was a hotbed for punk rock.
Yes.
All right. Well, I'm excited he's our guest. So while we have you here, Keith, you obviously have your finger on the pulse of everything happening in the food and dining scene in Cincinnati.
I try, bro.
You do a good job.
Yeah.
What are you excited about? What's happening on the scene right now that our listeners might want to know before we bring in Mike?
Ugh, lots of things. We have some new restaurants. We've got Marigold, which opened up over in the Foundry building downtown, which is in the same building as... Go ahead, sorry.
The former...
Macy's, yes.
Yeah.
So it's right around the corner from Jeff Ruby's and the Davidson. It's Anthony Siddick of the Crown Restaurant Group's newest restaurant. It's what we call a Desi pub, which is... in London, there are several Desi pubs. What they are usually British pubs that are owned by Indian families. So what you're getting there is you're getting a mix of British food, cottage pies, fish and chips, both wonderful, and Indian food like butter chicken and other dishes. They also make a great Pimm's Cup, which is one of my favorite cocktails. I know we're having Mike on, but,
a cocktail expert. Okay.
It's very big at Wimbledon.
Oh.
Yes.
I've not been.
Yes. Well, anyway.
I'm more of a mint julep Kentucky Derby guy.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's almost time for
I'll make
that,
you a Pimm's Cup sometime.
All right.
We'll have a happy hour. We also have news that Nicola's, which has been around for, I'm going to say 30 years in Over the Rhine, will soon be relocating to 4th Street in the former Pagals spot. That's big news. It's going to really revive 4th Street, I think.
We're seeing a lot of activity around what 3CDC is now marketing as the Fountain District.
Yep.
Which is right next to the Convention District. So,
And it's funny. I didn't really use Fountain District a lot when they first introduced it, but now I'm into it.
You're warming up to it?
I'm warming up to it. I'm using it.
Yeah?
Yeah.
I mean, it makes sense.
I like it.
So a lot of activity. Now, Longfellow's, thanks in part to you because we had a role in this, ended up on the list of top bars that USA Today put
yes.
out. So I've been there. When my boss came, he was curious to see Longfellow's since he had read about it in USA Today, and it did not disappoint.
Yeah.
It had that neighborhood bar feel. It was kind of busy that day. Like I bumped into some people I knew and you just had that sort of like, even though I don't go there a lot, it had that very friendly, I don't want to say a place where everybody knows your name because that's a little cliche, but it lived up to the hype, Keith.
Yeah. And what I also love about it is that the crowd there, you have 20 somethings through 60 somethings and maybe occasional 70 somethings hanging out there. So no matter how old you are, you're going to feel comfortable there. They also have some great bar food, including a scrap sandwich and whatever soup they have. I encourage you to order it because they make great soups there.
All right. Well, should we talk to the man himself?
Let's do it.
Let's do it. Let's bring on Mike Stankovich. Well, here we are with the special guest segment of our podcast. We are super excited to have Mike Stankovich with us today, who recently learned he is one of our region's nominees for James Beard Award. So welcome to the podcast and congratulations.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So as reported by Keith, this is a new category.
Yeah, it's the first year. I'm not an expert on it, but it's the first year they've done anything beverage related. Usually it's food, chefs, writing. I think that's it, right? So this year they added, I guess, the front of house categories. I'm not sure what they all are. And even my wife makes fun of me because I always mix up what my category is. I think it's...
I remember.
Oh, yeah, tell me what it is.
This category is Outstanding Professional in Cocktail Service.
Okay, there you go. I mix it up because they have the same thing, but beverage service, which I guess is for wine, more wine-driven. But, yeah, it's fun. There's three of us nominated, or semifinalists, and now it's down to two finalists. So it's good to be – I'm in good company.
And you find out in June, is that right?
June 16th.
June 16th. How did you find out you – became a finalist?
David Jackman, the other finalist, text messaged me. What should I not say?
No, that's fine. Yeah, okay. We love you.
This is a great story.
He's been a guest here.
He texted me, where are we getting drinks in Chicago? And that's how I found out.
Oh, that's great.
So I assumed really? That meant that I was I made it.
That's how you found out. Wow. Okay, so it's, you weren't waiting with your on your laptop for the announcements to be
hitting
made.
Refresh.
Hitting refresh. I was
I was not. Well, that's your job.
Yeah, thank you. That's true. Yeah. Point taken.
Well, I don't mean that. I mean, I was not. I mean, I was, to be honest, I forgot it was that day, and I think my wife Shayla was more getting ready to tune in to see what happened, what had happened. And then David Jackman texted me. So,
okay. Now, how did Shayla react?
I'm sorry.
How did Shayla react?
Oh, she loved it. She's very proud of me, very excited. She is making sure that we go to Chicago.
Was there any doubt where you're like,
No, I mean, I doubted I'd become a finalist, you know, cause it's a national category. And I think there was 12 to start. I don't know how many started. 18? Yeah. 12.
I think there were
18.
At least 12. But yeah. Somewhere between 12 and 18.
There was a good amount, you know, all across the country. And it's funny because it's like New York City, LA, Boulder, Hawaii, and then Cincinnati. So
yeah. And do you know any of the people you're up against?
I don't personally. No. Okay. I did know someone that was a semifinalist, a friend of a friend. The Baltimore bartender or bar owner was a friend of a friend. And I'd met him a few times. But when the James Beard, that day they announced they had whoever their publicist company is, had asked us to sign on to a Zoom thing. And so I kind of met some of the other nominees on that Zoom call for the first time.
Okay. So. And this isn't the first time that you or one of your restaurants has received a James Beard nomination. 2023, I believe, was Mid-City, your chef.
Francisco there. Was a semifinalist for Best Chef Great Lakes.
Yes.
Yes. Yeah, so that was the first. But it's more on, that's more his accomplishment than mine, you know.
And I know this from experience, go for the black tie, because last time I went to the James Beard Awards, I was so underdressed.
I know. That's what I'm worried about. Yeah, come on. All right.
Yeah. You got to do it.
I cut my own hair still. I guess I got to get a haircut.
I got a guy for you.
No, I got a guy. The barbershop.
I don't know how you cut your own hair. I can barely trim my own beard. Do you have like four mirrors you set up? And
I use.
It's not like you're bald and just do the shave thing. You got you.
So when
hair.
I had hair, I'm losing my hair, but I used to kind of pompadour it up, and where I grew up, no one could cut hair like that, so I had to kind of teach myself. But now I just get lazy.
Well, that's a great segue because. As we are wont to do on this podcast with special guests, I like to get into the origin story. Sure. When I was a kid reading comic books, those were my favorite editions, you know, like the origin of Spider-Man and all of that. So we know a little bit about you, thanks to Keith's reporting and other coverage. You're born in Virginia.
Yes.
And then Alexandria. You ended up in D.C.
Yep.
Which is not too far from Alexandria. You're northern
Virginia. Like a
mile. Yeah, northern Virginia is different from...
I went to elementary school about 8 miles outside of D.C.
Okay. And you were part of the punk rock scene in your 20s, which that was a scene. I mean, people would... That was a destination if that was your jam, right?
Yeah, it could kind of... D.C. was a pioneering scene in the hardcore punk scene that I was a part of. And it by the time I came around, it had kind of fizzled out in terms of bands being from DC.
Mm-hmm.
We still got good shows and everything. So, you know, I played music in high school and migrated towards the, so probably since I wasn't very good at playing music, I ended up in a punk band. but then somewhere our band did pretty well. I mean, not as well as at that time, like the music we play then, that genre now is very big. It's huge right now, but when we were kind of in a pendulum swing when it wasn't so big, but we still got to tour a lot. We toured Europe a few times, and basically anywhere we went, like if there was more than 5 people there, it'd be like 300 to 500 people, but sometimes there'd only be like 5 people there.
And the band was called Striking Distance.
Striking Distance, which is unfortunate because it's also the name of a bad Bruce Willis movie.
But that, so you don't have the Google authority with that name. If we Google
to put like punk or something next to it, but
scroll down a little bit.
Our singer was the name came from we were in another band before that, and we were touring, and we were teasing our singer, and he was driving, and to retaliate against our jabs, he jumped out of his seat and exclaimed, "You know better than to mess with me when you're in my striking distance." And then almost wrecked the van trying to punch us. So,
and if you want to look up YouTube clips of Mike in Striking Distance, God, I highly recommend it because Mike is, I know Mike is such a low key guy.
I'm skinny.
And when you see him on stage playing guitar, it is the opposite of low key. It is something to see.
Well, We don't have to make people Google that. We'll put the links in.
Oh, there we go.
On the when we publish this
prepare
podcast.
For a Cincinnati reunion after
you're
these
killing me. I try not. I'm fond of those days, and we've done a few reunions, but I try not to treat it like my glory days. My glory days are now. So if you want to see me when I'm not having as much fun,
a somber Mike.
Now you said you were touring. Were you opening up for any big acts, or were you kind of on a
in our scene? We were taken out on some tours for bigger bands, but nothing. You know, usually like when we would go to Europe at the time, it was enough just for an American band to be over there to headline. You know, so and you know, friends. Contemporaries of ours were, you know, big in Brazil or big in Japan, as they say, but our kind of niche was Western Europe. Well, we went into Poland and stuff, but you know, America, it's funny, America's so large geographically, it's easier. People are like, "Wow, you toured Europe?" And honestly, it was easier because our music was more popular over there at the time, and it's small. You can drive from, you know, we drove from Sweden to Spain in like a day, you know, which here that's, you can't even get across Texas in a day pretty much, you know. So touring here is really hard, and like monetarily speaking, it's a lot of gas money, a lot of driving, a lot of, you have to really want to do it.
Yeah.
And then you end up in like Tempe, Arizona in like August 2nd, and you're dying. You hate it, you know.
So it's not as glamorous as the Bon Jovi "Wanted Dead or Alive" video makes it look.
If you're Bon Jovi, it's probably pretty glamorous. We were all fighting with each other constantly and sleeping on floors, and you know, the first time I ever got to Europe, the first night we played a squat, which was a building that had been taken over by squatters. And they would do shows and donate, raise money to give back to the community. It was all positive. But we went to bed that night in the dark. And when we woke up in the morning, we were just surrounded by needles and broken glass and like that kind of stuff. And I remember being like,
sounds like train spotting a little bit.
Yeah. This is it. Yeah, it's very much like
so. I mean, that sounds punk rock to me.
It sounds fun, but it's not always the best.
But probably there are some, what, you know, kids of that era that have striking distance posters. Is that, I mean,
sure, yeah. We're still, strangely, we are still, I think we're not more relevant now, but younger generation has kind of gotten into this. You know?
Kind of going
and by
back
all means, I will stress again, we are not a big band. We were just had a little niche we carved out that
that's fun
worked well for us. You know, there's much bands we played with are much bigger now, you know, and that kind of thing. But,
and then at some point you ended up in New York, and that's where,
yeah. So I, well, in terms of origin story, the band thing is what kind of led me to restaurants. You know, yeah. it's subsidized my, this, it's what I advocate about restaurants today. And a lot of my employees are artists or, you know, have other passions. And the scheduling of restaurants, you know, I could go on tour for a month and come back and have a job. And so it kind of started as more of a necessity. And then I ended up, because of music, in Boston for a little bit. And somewhere in Boston is when I figured out that it would be my, the restaurants would be my career path.
Now, was this, we've talked a lot about your Bennigan's.
I have the old fashioned story of I was working in a mall a mile from my house when I was 17. And my buddy worked at Bennigan's and they were short staffed one night. And he came, I worked at Natural Wonders, which we sold like geodes and rain sticks and Enya CDs. It was a great job. I was 17 and they gave me a key to the mall to come in at like 1 a.m. to stock the store. And we used to skateboard in the mall and stuff. It was just great. No one cared. It was fun. But
did you say Enya CDs?
We had a music section. So I would always choose to work. We like Craig, like all new age stuff. But Enya.
Okay, we have officially covered the spectrum of music in the last
we're,
2 minutes.
We're going like Wyndham Hill kind of stuff.
Yeah. Craig Shakisel.
John Tesh.
Kitaro.
Yanni for sure. Yeah. Tons of Yanni Live at the Red Rocks came out, I think, the year I worked there in like 1994. It was a big seller. But I liked working in the music section, or I would sell telescopes. We sold telescopes. But anyway, classic story of my friend comes down. He's like, we're short staffed. Can you work tonight? And so I worked as a busser at Bennigan's and then stayed there. And then when I turned 18, became a server. And then it's crazy, like, it's Virginia, you could smoke inside at the time. We had a smoking section. But if you worked the smoking section on, like, Friday night, you'd make $200.
Yeah.
Which today is not bad. Like, but that was 1995.
Yeah.
And I just remember being like, man, this is crazy. So I think I was drawn in by the money and the schedule. And, you know, college wasn't – I'd gone to some community college, but once my band started touring, I was like, this is not – college is not going to work, you know. So, but it's funny, like, one of the guys in my band is now a doctor in geology, and so it's part of me is like, well, he pulled it off, like maybe I could have, but no regrets, you know. I don't know, but anyway, yeah, so Boston, I figured it out, and then yeah, we ended up in New York because my wife, she worked in fashion for Marc Jacobs, and they offered her a promotion. And it was one of those promotions where they were like, you have until the end of the week to decide. And then they paid for us to relocate there. So it was kind of dumb not to say yes. And there's a funny coincidental part. The same guy who got me to go work at Bennigan's was the drummer of my band. When I moved to New York, he was the director of operations for Roberta's.
Okay.
The same person.
And Roberta's, if you don't know, was just a game-changing restaurant in Brooklyn. It was a period when you saw a lot of restaurants, those big fancy white tablecloth restaurants in Manhattan, were giving way to more ingredient-focused smaller restaurants like Tom Colicchio's Craft and you know, Dan Barber's Blue Hill. Roberta's was sort of a part of that movement, I would say. The focus was pizza,
yeah,
but pizza made with the best ingredients, the best toppings. And it was kind of one of the first really big destinations in Brooklyn, where people were leaving Manhattan and going to Brooklyn. And you were part of the start of that whole thing.
Not like I came – I wasn't at the spark. I was more like right before the explosion. But I – like for when I moved there, because Eddie – the director of operations, Eddie, was a good friend of mine, and I'd kind of known these guys for years. I was just like, hey, I need a job. And I thought they were just going to help me find a job. And then I worked their first non-pizza thing they ever did on across from the Whole Foods on Houston and First. It was a tag team with the MoMA, and MoMA and some German engineering company had built this mobile food thing that was supposed to travel around the world. And I sold hamburgers at it outside every day. And it was my introduction to New York, was selling fancy hamburgers outside. And we were, you know, all kinds of celebrities were coming by. So I was just like, wow, this is New York's crazy, you know. But somewhere in there, they got their 2-star New York Times review. And that's kind of what. So I was there like 2 weeks before that happened. And that kind of is what exploded
there. For the hamburger joint.
No, for Roberta's. Okay. I just was at Roberta's hamburger stand.
Gotcha.
Then when that ended, they basically somehow didn't have, you know, they had a wine buyer and they had like a bar manager, but they kind of created the cocktail bar position for me, you know, head, whatever.
Which you excelled at like crazy. And then.
Well, were you, that's the part I'm curious about. So. Were you learning about cocktail making when you got that job, or had you been building up for that?
My stint in Boston is when it kind of blossomed. I had lived in Boston in 2007, which everyone kind of says was when the cocktail renaissance happened. And I didn't work in any super popular bars there, but I worked in a bar that was once a speakeasy, and we had a cocktail program, and it was still kind of rare, but we still treated it like a dive bar, which is like come and gone and trend, and it's trendy again right now, I think. But I was lucky in Boston to get, you know, some write-ups and that kind of thing and some press. And so I think my friends in New York thought I was a bigger deal than I was because of some articles and stuff when I actually got there. But I ended up at Roberta's for 3 years, and they just kept getting bigger and bigger. I mean, now they're global, you know,
Now, did you run the cocktail program at Roberta's?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
And, like they put out the cookbook and 3 drinks in there are mine. They don't credit anyone with it, but.
And then how long were you at Roberta's?
I think 3 years. Yeah.
And is that when you went to Alameda after that?
So after Roberta's, I was doing a little bit of consultant work.
Okay.
And the chef at Alameda, whose restaurant is now called El Pinguino in Greenpoint, and you should go check it out because it's great. But his girlfriend at the time worked with me at Roberta's, and he was having typical, like every business partnership, he was splitting up with his partner who had kind of run the cocktail side of things. So I started there as kind of just to help like consult or get it back on its feet, and then ended up staying there because I liked it.
Yeah. And every time I write about you, I mention this, the New York Times did a story on Alameda where they called you the Sam Malone of New York, of Brooklyn, or that.
Yeah.
Which is the New York Times saying that. That's a big deal. So when you got that publicity, did you see people coming in just to try your drinks at that point?
A little bit. I've never been able to kind of monetize or capitalize on some press I've had, which I struggle with. But I have friends being like, man, this is a big deal. You got to like do something.
Yeah.
And I never figured that out. But yeah, people came in. The times thing is funny too, because it was in the short-lived, I think it was like the men's style section or something. It was in a weird thing they tried for a little bit. So there's only like 8 of those articles. They were profiling like different people around New York.
Well, I remember that phase in publishing. I was out of the community for a while, but I came in to visit, and someone was trying to do a magazine called Cincinnati Gentleman.
Yeah.
And it was... Wait, did you write for that, Keith?
I just feel like you'd be on the cover of that.
I mean, perhaps if I was in town. I was in D.C. okay. when that came out. But it was very formatted. It was like... somebody talking about grooming, somebody talking about some clothes, somebody talking about like their favorite cocktail. It was like, I was pandering to us, man. We're so much more than, you know, beard wax and cocktails, aren't we?
Cigars.
Yes. So, yeah, I remember that in the Times because people in the publishing industry were holding it up saying, oh, we got to do something like this.
So I was lucky. I mean, it was, I guess the writer just was hanging out at Alameda and asked me to do the first one. But basically, I remember him telling me, he's like, this is kind of a guinea pig section we're trying out. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't about me being stylish or anything. I think it was more about the cocktails. Mm-hmm. And like, where, you know. But it was cool because Daniel Krieger took my photo and, you know, he's a big deal. And so that was, a lot of people asked me more about that. They're like, wow, you got to like, do photo with Daniel Krieger. You know, he's a big time food.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I'm sure you know who he is. But.
So what was the first original cocktail you made? What was your first?
The first one that I got press for was in 2005. So it was pre-cocktail renaissance, but it was still a cocktail, but it was a pumpkin French 75, which is actually still really good.
Yeah.
And I remember that was the first time in Boston, the Boston Globe or somebody did a blurb on it. Or what was the like weekly
Boston magazine?
No, like the, it'd be like City Beat here.
Oh, I don't know what their alt weekly was called in Boston.
What the hell was that called? But it was in there.
And okay.
So that was fun. And
so now you're this guy who is known in New York, featured in the New York Times, the Sam Malone of a trendy bar. And here's where it gets interesting. You come to Cincinnati.
Yeah. So New York had kind of, I think we were, you know, New York's constantly evolving and changing. We were there when I got there late, but I think everybody gets there late, if you know what I mean. But we kind of got, Shayla and I, my wife lived there. She's from here. So we were deciding to move maybe upstate or to Portland, Maine, or here. And we decided here. Because family was here. I've been coming to Cincinnati on and off for 20 years. And honestly, to me, it was like, as someone who likes to travel, I was like, man, we're 4 hours from Chicago, 4 hours from Detroit, 2 hours from in, you know, it seems like a good kind of launching pad. And I lived all over the East Coast. So it's basically just moved back, you know? And then
what was your game plan when you got here?
To open Longfellow, that was a big plan. Shayla had landed a job at Artworks, and she now runs a nonprofit that is focused on reshoring garment manufacturing back to the States, called So Valley. And so that kind of took her a couple years to get going, but she got it going. And right now it's doing very well. So they do education, and they have a fabric recycler that they just got in. It's pretty cool. It's like one of the only ones in the Midwest.
Yeah.
Did you have Over the Rhine on your radar? Is that where you wanted to?
It wasn't specifically. I looked kind of all over. Honestly, I had the luxury of having family here, so I'd flown out a few times just to meet people. I made a conscious decision to try to network ahead of time. And the not necessarily more to just raise capital and that kind of thing. You know, I didn't have a ton of money, and asking people for money has never been my strong suit. So the hardest thing about Longfellow was getting meetings over coffee with people and then telling them what I need and where I wanted to go, because for better or for worse, I knew I didn't want any partners, because back to Roberta's, they started as friends. They ended up in multi-million-dollar lawsuits with each other and that whole thing. So I wanted to avoid that. But I think what I couldn't have planned for was I ended up moving here, and Longfellow took a while to get off its feet. So I ended up working for Jose Salazar for a little while, and then my friends at the Northside Yacht Club. And it wasn't planned, but it worked out in my favor, in terms of it wasn't just some guy, some like carpetbagger from New York coming to open a bar. I'd lived here, you know, I'd made friends. I had, was able to share kind of my vision. And so it seemed more like a local opening a bar rather than, oh, this hotshot from New York, you know, which Cincinnati has mixed feelings on. So I'm glad that worked out. That was not planned.
Yeah.
And I think it was favorable, and, you know, the kind of the kismet part of it, or whatever, not kismet, but the luck part of it.
And one of the remarkable things about Longfellow and Mid-City, which I've mentioned it in my articles, but people mention it all the time to me, is your staff. You just have one of the nicest, coolest, most... they're cool, but they're so friendly. You get eye contact the second you walk through the door. I feel like most of the people who work for you have been there for a long time. Like, what is your interview process like when you're hiring? What are you looking for? Because I think you've assembled one of the most enviable staffs in Cincinnati.
Well, thank you. That's the best. Honestly, that's the compliment I care about the most. I think part of it is I'm a lifer in the industry, and so I kind of know how to treat restaurant staff better, but my interview process is very shoddy. I usually just like, I hired John Warren off Craigslist, and he thinks that's hilarious. But
oh, really? Okay,
that was probably the last Craigslist hire in America. But he
is Craigslist still
John's a great guy.
I think so.
I don't know. Yeah.
But he's been with me, you know, he left for a minute, but he's been there 7+ years. But I do this weird thing that people are put off by sometimes. I kind of just bring people in very informally. I glance at their resume. I meet them in person. I ask them a few questions. And then I usually have them come stage, as they call it, like work a shift, but
yeah,
I pay them for it. I don't ask anyone to ever work for free. And then kind of to see the personality fit, you know, because certain things you can't teach people. I could teach, I'd rather, you know, it's cliche, but I'd rather hire someone with a good personality than better, like, than a great skill set, because I can teach them that, you know. Skill set helps, but, and then it's kind of just maintaining culture, you know. You lose, every time, you know, someone, there's transition, you lose a little culture, but then maybe you gain it, you can get it back, you know. And so I think also just keeping up with it is important. And then I have people I trust, you know. We just, Josh just left after 7 years, and that's a big blow, but he's on to better pastures, and, you know, I'm glad to have been able to have him there for as long as I had, you know.
Yeah,
if that makes sense.
Yeah,
but honestly, it's the best compliment, because without people coming in or people to work for me, what would I be doing? I'd just be standing there by myself. So.
Yeah, and you're still there. You're working every
night.
Yeah,
I still I like working.
And usually more at Mid-City now, though.
So I'll be back. And now that Josh is gone, I'll be back at Longfellow more. But I'm lucky to have people I can trust. And
yeah. And if anybody hasn't been to Longfellow or Mid-City, not only are the drinks great, and not only is the staff great, but the food is really something. And at Longfellow, you mentioned that you had kind of, when you designed the menu for Longfellow, it was based a little bit on a place called McSorley's in New York, which is like this, the most old man bar in the world. So you were just serving radishes, saltines with, raw on, or what was it that was, dish?
Oh, the liverwurst.
The liverwurst.
Liverwurst, yeah. With saltines, raw onions, and mustard.
Yeah.
Which it's still on the menu. It's great.
Yeah. And the famous scrap sandwich, if anybody hasn't had that, it's literally just scraps from the other sandwiches they're making.
Yeah.
thrown on a.
It was so. That's if we have time. That's kind of a little interesting story. Just we that was from necessity because we wanted Longfellow to have a kitchen. I'm sure I've told you this, but yeah. The building Longfellow's in is one of the only, I think the only building in all of Over the Rhine that's exposed on all four sides with no courtyard. So we couldn't run a hood because of the historic board. So we tried to just do as much food as we could without
and for
a real
those
kitchen.
Who haven't worked in restaurants like us, a hood is vital for a kitchen because otherwise everything you're cooking doesn't vent out. You need something to, you know, exhaust to pull all of that out.
Yeah. So if you had like an open flame, you'd have to have a suppression system, which would put a fire out if it were to happen, and then a exhaust system to take the smoke out. So it was fun though. We just would push, you know, we've had Casey Hopkins is our chef now at Longfellow, but we've had some other people come and go, and just like Casey uses a little convection oven and makes hanky pankies now that are really good and all.
One of my favorites, And she's the one who made the tomato soup, right?
Yeah, yeah. She
the
does all
best
her
tomato.
Soups.
One of the best tomato soups I've had in the city. Yes.
So it's fun to see it's fun to have that limitation so you can see how you can work around it. You know.
Yeah.
To be honest, it's fun.
Yeah. Like, and the menu at Mid City is an entirely different beast. You know, that's much more of a restaurant than a bar.
Yeah.
Although the bar is wonderful and you can just hang out there. But the food that you're serving there is kind of your takes on street foods from different cultures, some of it.
Sort of.
And
I can't articulate it very well.
It's I can't either. So please help me. Yeah.
I don't know. It's when we opened, we talked about what we didn't want to make. So
what was on that list? Like stuff that's played out at
not played out just that Cincinnati had too much of. Like it's unfortunate because I grew up making pasta with my grandmother. So pasta was on the do not make list because like five pasta restaurants have opened in the last year. No, nothing against any of those. But you know, I'm not going to do it as well as they're going to do it. So leave that to them. Hamburgers were one of them, although we do hamburgers, but we had it as a secret menu item for a long time. But now they're on the menu. Fried chicken was one because I wouldn't make it as good as someone else. So I think we kind of went – there's a chef named Jamie Bissonette in Boston was loosely a format inspiration for me. He has a restaurant called Little Donkey where he – it's loosely Asian inspired, but there's nothing off limits for his kind of what he mixes together, you know? And so I think that's kind of what we did. Now he's a much better, like, chefy chef than we try to be. You know, we try to keep it casual. But I think the fact that we just kind of do whatever we want, whenever we want, is what makes it hard to articulate. Now, and it's nothing crazy, but, you know. But yeah, I'm loosely inspired by street food, you know, preparations because we have a small kitchen. And part of one thing I would say to my like the chef, if he's like, man, I can't figure this out. I'm like, well, there's a 2x2 stall in Singapore right now making better food than any restaurant in Cincinnati. So
yeah.
We can figure it out, you know? So I think that's kind of the inspiration which doesn't really
I like that.
Clear things up. But.
I like that philosophy of not letting limitations limit you, but letting it provide a challenge and you end up with something totally unique and different.
Yeah.
Is that a metaphor similar? Is that something that would describe you as a person, your ethos, how you approach life?
Maybe. I mean, I'm an anxious person inside, I think. And I don't wake up and see like, oh man, I can't do this. You know, if that makes sense. Like, I don't know. I never really thought about it. I just kind of go.
So I have some specific cocktail questions to ask you.
I hope I can answer them. Well, since
and to give you like, I'm so interested in this, and I'm so excited you're going to be here. So, one of the things I did during the pandemic was start to pay attention to cocktails.
Yeah.
You know, because you had to start making them at home for a little bit, right? And I probably damaged my going out experience because now it's like, I don't want a cocktail if someone hasn't put some thought into it, because it's like, now I've learned just enough about it to be dangerous and to know this cocktail's terrible or wow, this cocktail's awesome and whatever. So, but as I've become this like student of cocktails, I have a few questions for you. Okay. First question is, when you're mixing a cocktail, does proof matter? Like some people say it's got to be low proof so it doesn't overpower the other ingredients. Some people say high proof. Otherwise, what's the deal there?
I think it matters. I don't know if it's a deal breaker or not. But it definitely matters if you're using, like a good example is if you're making a classic Manhattan and you have a super strong sweet vermouth like Carpano Antica, you might want to use a whiskey that has a higher proof to hold up to that sweetness. But if you're making it at home, you can always just cut back on the vermouth enough to match the sweet to alcohol ratio. So I think it's a new, you know, it's a trick.
Okay.
But having said that, in restaurants or bars I've run, we've changed the vermouth based on the spirit and the proof of that spirit to not overpower the spirit or vice versa. So I do think it matters, but I think are you asking for like home?
Just use? In general, like when people.
I'd say it matters. Now, my favorite Manhattan in Cincinnati is at Maury's Tiny Cove.
Yay.
And yay. Keith and I. I'm going to get. Old man bar.
I'm going to get. You know, someone's going to probably scoff at that. I don't care.
Because it's an honest, straight up old school.
It's just taste. Yeah. They use vermouth that no one uses anymore because everyone switched to fancy vermouth. So it reminds, it's nostalgic for me.
Okay.
Having said that, I don't care how they, what they're doing. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's good based on my environs and, you know, all that kind of thing. Everything around me makes it taste good. But if you're going into your, you know, if you're going to spend $16 on a cocktail, I would say that it matters, you know?
Okay. Do you refrigerate your vermouth?
Yes.
Always?
Always.
Okay. That's another thing that.
What happens to vermouth if you don't refrigerate it?
It's just like wine. It's wine based. So there's not enough alcohol in it to. It just turns and
gets
flavor.
Nasty.
It just spoils. It's still drinkable.
But what?
Like I said, every vermouth before 2000, every Manhattan you ever had before 2007 probably was with unrefrigerated vermouth.
Oh, yeah. It's a lesson.
So if you
I
like that flavor.
And that's why I'm asking, because like people like me that are like trying to learn about it, talking to people who've made cocktails their whole life, they're like, why are you even refrigerating your vermouth? Like,
yeah,
I
think in today's world,
you're a poser.
The difference between going out for a drink and making drinks at home is if you're going to go out for a drink and drop money on it, they should be treating their ingredients properly.
I agree. Okay.
So that's more why I think it matters. You know.
Another question I have. I have seen on the TikTok and on the YouTube people that swear by adding a drop or two of salt water to a cocktail to, like, just when you season food to bring out the flavor.
Yeah.
Do you do that?
We keep saline behind the bar. And so saline sounds pretentious, but
it's salt water.
It's salt water that's been diluted to
a specific.
So we have a ratio. So just like if you were to make simple syrup, there's a recipe, you know, equal parts by weight, sugar and water. Mm-hmm. The salt water or saline is the same thing. We don't do it. We do it to specific drinks, that kind of thing. We wouldn't just do it without telling you or something.
What type of drink benefits from
a Negroni is great with three drops of salt in it.
Three drops of saline.
Well, depending on your ratio of saline.
Okay. All right.
So that when I order a Negroni, that's automatic?
No. You'd have to ask for it or we would talk about it. Yeah. Oh, okay. Well, you can do it. So we have a dropper of saline behind the bar.
Interesting.
But, I did not know that.
Obviously, like a martini would be good because people already like dirty martinis, which is basically adding
olive brine,
which is mostly salt.
Yeah.
But I do think, grapefruit flavor. So Campari's got a little bit of that grapefruit mojo and salt go really well together. So like margaritas, there's salt on. So actually, when someone orders a margarita and they're at the bar, we ask them if they want salt on it or in it.
Okay.
And then, because I don't really like the salt texture, but I like the salt flavor in a margarita. Okay. So
you don't like your glass rim. Do you want a little bit of salt? Okay.
So I would just do no salt. I'm not fussy. So I wouldn't be like, oh, you don't have saline here. I don't want your margarita. But if you have it, it's good. A good alternative, you know.
All right. Last question. Yeah. I could go on. All right.
Sure.
Smoked cocktails. Is this just a party trick or does smoke have its place in certain cocktails?
So I personally am not a fan at all.
Why?
Because if you think about smoke in the food world, it's usually a thing that takes like a lifetime to master. You know, like my dad was a pit master. I'm a pit master. They're just throwing smoke at these drinks. And I don't think anyone, I'm sure there are places on earth that are doing very, very good smoke cocktails. But when I see it as just kind of like a gimmick or on the menu, I don't think it's probably done properly. And then all I taste is the smoke. You know, I think nuances in liquid should be inside the liquid, not outside of the liquid.
Not a cloud on top of
it.
You
know what I mean? But that's just a person. That's a me thing.
So you're not hating.
I don't hate on. I don't hate on it, but I will say I do think there are bars that do. You know, it's probably like, for example, having worked at Bennigan's, and you'll see drink trends on corporate menus 2 years after they've been a thing. And so I guarantee you could go to a chain restaurant right now and get a smoked cocktail.
Right.
And that's not bad. That just means, are they doing it right? Are they doing it well? What kind of wood are we using? What kind of, you know, There's all this nuance that probably gets overlooked with someone who doesn't actually care about it. But like I said, there have to be bartenders that have perfected this thing. So,
all right. Last question. Yeah. If I go to Longfellow, and I want to have a cocktail that you would call one of your signature cocktails, can't get anywhere else, blow my mind, what do I need to order?
I don't know if it's going to blow your mind, because that's hard to do with anybody.
I don't know. I'm pretty.
Your whiskey sour blew my mind. I wrote a whole article.
Yeah,
about
but that's
it.
Just a whiskey sour.
I know, but it was the best whiskey sour I've ever had in my life.
Well, thank you. Yeah. If we have a minute, my philosophy is a philosophy called know your bar, right? So I think to your question, you asked the good question, what's a cocktail on your menu that you like? You know, I see people go to dive bars and try to get Manhattans and old fashions, and it's just, you shouldn't do that. You should go there and get what you think the bar does well. But so having said that, I think Longfellow, we do our best selling drinks called a Shiso Painkiller, which is a riff on a classic tiki drink called a painkiller that's Pusser's rum, cream of coconut, orange juice, and pineapple juice. We blend shiso leaf into ours, which is a Japanese herb.
Okay. And I'm glad you said that because I thought you said she's so.
Shiso.
Yeah. Okay. So we're talking about the herb.
The herb, shiso. Okay.
All right.
And we blend that into the mix and it adds a little bit of flavor, but it makes it green. And that's a good selling drink. Fresh orange juice. You know, we make it all fresh. But I think my favorite drink on our menu that's been on there forever is called the Spruce Goose. And it is a gin cocktail. It's gin, some Amish honey we get from a couple counties north of here. Lime juice, fresh lime juice. But the reason it's kind of a special drink is it's got a quarter ounce of Angostura bitters in it. So, you know, normally in a Manhattan, you'd have two or three drops.
Mm-hmm. So a quarter ounce is like a tablespoon?
Probably a teaspoon.
Teaspoon, yeah. Okay.
Yeah. But that's a lot
of bitters, yeah.
It's a lot. Mm-hmm. So it adds this kind of unique flavor you don't really get anywhere else. And it sells well. It sells. Some people hate it. That's why I don't know if it's going to blow your mind.
I'm going to try it.
What I would recommend.
I think the painkiller is mind-blowing.
I think the last time I had a good painkiller, I was in Key West or something like that.
Yeah.
And they always have, you know, you get it with a floater, right? Now, does yours come with a floater?
No, you could. We don't offer it. We already do. Our house pour in Longfellow is a 2 ounce pour. Most bars do an ounce and a half. So you're technically getting the floater. So
that's good to know too, because so your house pour is 2 ounce.
Yeah.
You say most do
an ounce and a half, usually.
Which which is another reason why I spoiled myself during the pandemic, because let's say when I was learning to make cocktails, again, TikTok and YouTube, right? Let's say I quickly started making mine what you would call spirit forward. Right? And so pandemic's over, I go out to eat, order a cocktail, and it must have been an ounce and a half because I was like, this is not spirit forward. I've ruined myself. I can't have a drink.
Having attended
anymore.
Several holiday parties at Burl's house for the Enquirer, I can tell you that very spirit forward, uber worthy, definitely.
All right. Well, Mike Stankovich, we can't thank you enough for coming in again. Congratulations on the nomination.
Thank you.
We're all crossing our fingers here that you win, because that'll be a great story for you to write, Keith. About
well, Keith has a you have one right of Jesus Spirit Award. Other than
it's tarnished now, though. It's so old.
No. Other than you, the only Cincinnati James Beard Award is at Camp Washington Chili.
Yeah, Camp Washington does have the American Classics James Beard.
But that's the only winner, right? Jean Robert was up for a bunch. Jose.
Yeah, so please join us, Mike.
We just made it sound like The Shining.
It's like the SNL Five Timers Club or something.
You know,
like
I don't want to say Keith flexes on that, but it was on top of his resume when he tried to.
Hell yeah, it was.
You also got it for writing, right?
That was for the journalism.
That's
awards,
hard.
Which are the same weekend as the Chef Awards this year. So Chicago have all the great food writers and great chefs. And
is that in New York?
They're all in Chicago now. Oh. Same weekend.
Oh, wow.
So it's going to be
a big,
if you big
win, I'm
Chicago.
Sure there's like a secret handshake that Keith is going to teach you and all that stuff.
They'll open a door in the Lyric. It's at the Lyric Opera House. Be like a secret party.
Well, I am wishing you luck. I would love you to bring one home, and David as well.
Honestly, I think I'm only nominated, obviously, because there's a new category. And I think everyone that's been nominated in Cincinnati – somewhere, sometimes, someone's got to win one. Jose's been up there a bunch. Jean Robert was in there a bunch, right?
Yeah.
Jeff Harris.
Jeff Harris
from Nolia.
Mochico over there.
Mochico. Yeah. It's just funny. You know, it's got to happen sooner or later.
Maybe if you win, it'll spark the reunion of your punk rock band just to celebrate.
We'll see.
All right. Well, Mike, thanks again for coming in.
Thank you. Yeah,
thanks, Mike.
All right. Well, I had about five other cocktail questions I could have asked, but I felt I didn't want to go into the weeds a little bit. So I'm going to have to maybe ask him if he'll teach a master's class in cocktails. That would be fun.
Yes, I will sign up for that.
All right. So, Keith, as we are wont to do on the final segment of the That's So Cincinnati podcast, is talk about something that is so Cincinnati. And you know it when it happens. You know it when you see it. You know when you experience it because you go, oh boy, that was pretty Cincinnati. Have you had a moment like that recently?
Yes, I have. Mine happened last weekend when my daughter was born in Brooklyn. And she always reminds me that she was born in Brooklyn because she thinks that's pretty cool. But
it is pretty cool.
Really hoping that she would, you know, fall in love with our fair city, Cincinnati, Ohio. So the other day we were over in Northern Kentucky and I was playing REM on the radio when we were, you know, heading toward the Roebling Bridge. And when we got to the bridge, my daughter said, "Daddy, will you turn the music off?" Because she wanted to listen to that beautiful sound you hear, that hum when you go over the Roebling. And we were just completely quiet on that little drive over the bridge. And I thought, how great is it that she now appreciates this as much as I did when I was a kid?
That is a sweet,
pretty sweet, right?
Sweet story.
Yeah.
You know, it makes you wonder if that hum is a specific note, or does it matter? Ooh. Like, does it depend on the tires and the weight of your car or something? Maybe we should ask Jenny Key, our editor of our breaking news team, to do a just asking feature on that.
I like that.
What key is the Roebling Bridge?
Yeah, we can sell with the Cincinnati Symphony or something
maybe.
Like that.
Maybe they can figure it out. That's a great idea.
They can work it into a...
Now, my brother has perfect pitch, which I hate him for because I'm so jealous of that. So I'm going to drive him over and see if he can just name it, you know.
Yeah.
It's like B flat or a C sharp, I think.
Or you could just watch Rain Man.
Yes. That's very Cincinnati,
yes.
Watching Rain Man. Yes. That'd be another, that's a Cincinnati thing to do, is list the movies.
Where, yeah. And the Roebling, as you, if you don't recall, makes a very, has a very big moment in that movie. So.
All right. Well, before we wrap up, I have to ask you, and I'm putting you on the spot.
Oof.
What is the best thing? Because this is your job, to go out and eat things.
Yeah.
It's a wonder you're not 250 pounds. You must be working out or something.
We're very tight undershirts.
it's
like a girdle.
The male version of Spanx in undershirt kind of form.
Yeah.
You know, I think they actually have those things.
They do. I've looked into them.
You're vouching for it. Yeah. I see. Okay. Yeah. What have you eaten in the last week or so that you were excited about?
I personally was, I don't know how excited you will be about this, but I had Menudo, which is a tripe.
A band with
no,
Ricky
not
Martin.
The band. No, Menudo is a traditional Mexican soup. Which
so the
I
band
had,
was named after a soup?
I believe so.
Interesting.
I got to look into
Sorry,
that,
I keep interrupting.
But
Menudo
at,
the soup.
Tapia Taqueria or Taqueria Tapia over in Covington. It is a tripe soup that is cooked in this chili pepper base. And it is spicy and comforting and just lovely. The Taqueria is behind the Anchor Grill, if you need a landmark.
Okay. But
I really love that. It comes with a bunch, you know, chopped onions, chopped jalapenos, lime that you just kind of keep adding as you eat. If you haven't had tripe, it is really a lovely meat. It doesn't taste like much, but it absorbs all the flavors.
It's intestines, correct?
It is stomach lining.
Stomach lining.
Stomach lining.
Okay.
Yeah. Which
so it's not really a meat, it's organ.
It's all
meat. Yeah. Okay. I'm not hating on it. Just
no, I really enjoy it.
You know, I'm a journalist, so I have to ask these probing questions.
Yeah, like, no, I get it. I get it.
So tripe soup.
Yeah.
I'm game.
Big fan. And also pizza, Neapolitan pizza at Joe's Pizza Napoli in Milford. Fantastic. I'll be writing about that soon.
Pizza Napoli?
Joe's Pizza Napoli.
Okay. Like,
it's a true Neapolitan pizza.
Nice.
Like, as authentic as they come.
Okay.
They do a great version there. So it's in an odd strip mall by a Walmart, but
sometimes those are the best places to get good food.
Exactly.
Man, you have taken us from Covington to Milford in like a heartbeat.
I care about all of Greater Cincinnati, Burl, as you know.
As you should.
Yes, yes.
All right. Well, shall we wrap this up?
Yeah.
All right. Thank you for listening to this week's episode of the That's So Cincinnati podcast, a production of The Enquirer and Cincinnati.com.
Thanks again. See you next week.
No.
What am I supposed to say? Guest host.
So I
sorry.
Just read that. Thank you for listening to this week's episode of the That's So Cincinnati podcast, a production of The Enquirer and Cincinnati.com.
And if you enjoyed the podcast, please give us a rating and share it with a friend who loves all things Cincinnati.
And finally, if you value local journalism, and I know you do, and haven't subscribed for full digital access to Cincinnati.com, now is a great time. Just go to Cincinnati.com and click on the subscribe button to see a special offer just for you.
Thanks again. We'll see you next week.